Thank you, Wayne.
Wayne Butler, alcoholic?
No, Wayne.
By God's grace, the power of 12 steps and the fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since the 8th of November, 1977. I'm pretty happy about that. I also haven't had any pills, powders, potions, or lotions that unnecessarily alter my emotions from that day to this. I must say, however, I have dated some mind and mood-altering women. I'm just saying. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to participate this weekend with you folks. I know many of you here. I love many of you. I know many of you love me. It makes me feel good about myself. And, I'm not sure if you love all of us, but I want to thank Arnie for picking me and Richie up and shuttling us around the weekend. I love this thing. I hope you love AA, too. And if you don't get into service, you'll soon fall in love with AA. I found out the word love means something contrary to what I thought. I thought if you said you love me, you'd do for me. I found out love is for me to serve. And it's taken me a while to learn that, and I hope you do too if you have not. You know, I'm here to share my experience. I want to thank Richie for his talk Friday night. I love how he talks. Wasn't he great Friday night? He has a way of articulating and making sense. Well, that's not what you're getting tonight. See, with him, you got a college graduate. With me, I rode the short bus, so there you go. I'm the kid that wore a helmet and didn't ride a bike, you know what I'm saying? My sponsor said I'm an over-under achiever. I'm here because Dr. Silkworth says that I have the incapacity, the inability to manage my drinking. And I have an insane idea that someday I'll find a way, or science will, that I can control and enjoy my drinking. I don't believe that day's arrived yet, and I'm not going to trust it if it does. My life today is more important than it ever was to me. And I want to add, if you're new, I want to welcome you. I saw those of you who stand it for under a year. I hope you stay, but I have to tell you something. The odds are stacked against you. I have to tell you that. It'd be irresponsible of me not to tell you that. The odds are against you until you commit yourself to the AA way of life. Then the odds are unbelievably in your favor. Make no mistake about that. I hate to be a buzzkill right out of the gate because I know we're here about the fun. When's the fun start? Grab a broom. That don't sound like fun. Sweep. Some things in AA didn't make sense to Wayne Butler. I have to tell you, I love AA. I love AA with every ounce of my being. I also have to wrap myself out. And by the way, I also want to say I'm glad that my friends Debbie and Ken are here. A lot of you I've known for years. And it does my heart good to see you still here, because I'd hate to think I'm alone in this journey. And you new people know, I want you to know I'm here because I stand on the shoulders of the giants who came before me. I want you to know that. Um, 38 years sober, one day at a time. I may have a day where I'm jarring a popcorn fart, but I'll tell you something. I didn't mean to say that. That just slipped right out. I don't got no toilet paper up here for my mouth or nothing. I want to say that the day could come you could see me drunk again. I have to get that out there, too. I've got to get that stuff out of there right away. There's a day you could see me drunk again someday. Make no mistake about it. And please don't come up and tell me, nah, you got it, you're good. I've seen too many people with over 30 years. And I didn't know why, and I'll talk about that a little later. I didn't understand the spiritual disease of alcoholism. I did not understand it. You see, I'm a beer drinker, and I'm a periodic as well. But I'm a beer drinker, and we all know beer drinkers can't be alcoholic, right? And I also like fine wine, like Ripple. How many of you remember Ripple? Well, you really shouldn't put your hands up because we all know you're over 40. Now, I'm going to tell you why you people under the age of 40 ain't never drank Lip Ripple, so don't lie. It's because the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, when they came into existence, the first thing they did was shut that chemical plant down. Let me tell you, they've never seen your vineyards, I'll promise you that. Ripple went right by it. My other favorite wine, Thunderbird. I love Thunderbird. Little Cisco Kid. Little Mad Dog Deucey Deucey. How about some Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill? I know where I am. Now, in case you're new, I want to caution you. I want to inform you about an alcoholic terminal condition here in Santa Rosa. When you drink Budweiser and Boone's Farm and Ripple and Cisco and Thunderbird, you will get a case of alcoholic terminal diarrhea. I have to tell you, I had diarrhea for 6 years. When you've had diarrhea for 6 years, you better have good decision-making skills. And you better have split-second timing, too. Apparently, I had neither. So I had issues. My condition had a condition. See, I didn't know what alcoholism looked like. It took me a while in AA to come to discover that. You know, I come from an alcoholic home. I need to tell you that. But I don't want to blame my parents. I'm just reporting. My father was an alcoholic by his own confession. And I was raised by a pack of wolves. I was. I'm not blaming. I'm reporting. When you're raised by a pack of wolves, even though you're a genteel poet like myself, you're going to turn out to be a wolf, whether you like it or not. That's the way it is. My story is not like Rich's. My family was horribly sick. I'm glad I know that, by the way. I used to thought they were bad and evil. My dad was a truck driver. He was mobbed up out of Chicago. He ran illegal whiskey and cigarettes for years. Wasn't nothing for him to come home with that tractor trailer with bullet holes in it. My brother wanted to be like my dad. My dad wanted me to be like him. He caught me writing a poem one time when I was 9 years old. And he beat the holy hell out of me for writing that poem. Don't judge my dad. My dad was a sick man. We're going to try to understand him. Never wrote another poem. That's not my dad's fault. That's my fault. I didn't know that's how I reacted to things. See, I'm never going to drink brown whiskey. Because you see, my daddy drinks brown whiskey, and he beats my mother half to death. My mom drinks tequila. And she's German, which is really interesting. But when my mom drinks tequila, she's aware of when my dad passes out. She gets even on a regular basis. You know, the other truckers from Chicago come over to the house. They got poker parties every Friday and Saturday. Everybody's getting all drunked up. My brother, he wants to join in the fun. I am scared to death. And I don't know what it is that they're drinking, but I ain't never drinking that. I'm never drinking that brown whiskey. I don't even know it's alcohol. I'm never going to drink that stuff my mom drinks. I drink Pepsi Cola. And now when you're raised in a home like that, now it's going to sound like I'm telling a pre-Al-Anon story, so hang with me for a minute. I promise I'm going to become an alcoholic. I know it's a surprise to me, too. Growing up in that alcoholic home, you know, it won't make you an alcoholic, but it'll put a definite spin on your personalities. I'll tell you that right now. And my spin showed up in school. I was that kid that was just weird. You know, I'm talking about in 1957, 1958, 1959, you know, 1959 B.C. That's before cell phones, in case you don't know. I'm eating pencils. I'm biting people. They call it acting out now. They didn't know what to call it back then. They didn't know what to do with Lil Wayne. Not that Lil Wayne, this Lil Wayne. They didn't know what to do with me. I'm not drinking, but I'm starting to exhibit bizarre behavior. By the time I'm 9 years old, I'm seeing a counselor. I'm seeing a therapist. I'm being medicated by the time I'm 9 years old. Don't know what's wrong with me, kids. Have no clue. I don't even know there's something wrong with me. Fast forward to eighth grade, and they sent me to an expert. And they're going to administer a test to try to figure out just what's wrong with old Lil Wayne over there. Something wrong with him. They didn't have those modern tests they have today. You know what they administered to me? They administered the IQ test, thinking that would give a bead to me. Now, how many of you in this room have taken the IQ test? Come on, I know a lot of you have. I can see the smarts rising. Let me explain something to you about the IQ test. If you score over 100, you're pretty smart, right? If you score over a 120, you're borderline genius. You score a 150 or higher, there's an organization called Mensa that will recruit you to sit in a room. They will pay you ungodly amounts of money to think. I promise you, they've never come to a participation meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous recruiting anybody. If you score over a 180, they just want you to stay home. You're too smart to drive your car. I want you to know what Wayne Butler scored. I scored a 57. And I didn't cheat. And I got diagnosed mentally retarded. Now, if you've got special needs children, please don't be offended by what I'm about to share. This is just my story. And because I got diagnosed mentally retarded, they put me in a class called the mentally retarded. It wasn't special education yet. And I was in there with 10 other kids. Most of them had what we now know as Down syndrome. I went to that class in eighth grade, and I went all the way through high school in that class. I swear before God I never read a book, not one book. They tried to teach us how to tie our shoes, how not to eat pencils, how to keep us from running our head into the wall for attention. I know this don't sound like alcoholism yet if you're not aware. I'm going to try to make you aware of something tonight. And they lined us up with other kids in our class to kind of look after us, right? To kind of protect us from the bullies. You know who you are. You're here. I saw you. You know those bullies that pick on kids weaker than them so they look tougher than what they really are? I know what a bully is. I don't have resentment. I've got clarity. I share that for a reason that'll come out in a little bit. Well, as I'm going through school, Tom, he's been assigned to go along with me in school and kind of look out for me. Tom is my guy. And once I'm in 10th grade, we get some new lockers in our school. You know those big, tall hall lockers? Well, three wrestlers thought they'd have some fun with the kids in the special class. And on a Friday night, they grabbed three of us, including myself, and they locked us in those hall lockers. And they didn't find us till Monday. So I stood in a hall locker from Friday evening till Monday when the janitors came in. Now, that didn't make me an alcoholic, but it did give me my ticket to resentment. Tom found those three wrestlers, and he beat the holy heck out of all three of them. Tom became my hero for life right there. And Tom looked after me from that point on. Don't sound like alcoholism yet, does it? I've got this twisted personality, and I'm broken. Fast forward to our senior year. I'm about to graduate high school. We're at the senior dance. I'm the only one from the special class that got to go to the senior dance. I'm still not drinking brown whiskey. I'm not drinking that clear stuff. I don't want nothing to do with that stuff. And we're at the senior dance, right? Some of the boys brought some liquor. Well, Tom, he comes walking across the dance floor. He's got his hand in his jacket. He comes walking right up to me. And he pulls out this brown bottle with a red, white, and blue label, Budweiser. Tom says to me, "Here, kid, drink this. It'll make you feel better." I would have drank battery acid for Tom. You hear me? I didn't know I was a guzzler yet, but I learned it pretty quick. I took that whole bottle of Budweiser and guzzled it all down. Apparently, I've been thirsty a long time. And I let out a big old belch, and I said to Tom, "Tom, that tastes terrible. I want a Pepsi-Cola." Tom said these immortal words, "That's okay, kid. Have another one. You'll get used to it." Now, here's what Tom, who is a friend of mine even today, here's what Tom meant by that statement. You see, Tom's dad was a millionaire. He was filthy rich. And his whole basement was a big bar with wine racks. And then one night, Tom got into his dad's liquor and got drunk. Apparently, he had to go to the bathroom. He thought he was in the bathroom. He was in the bedroom. And he thought he was standing over the stool. It was an open drawer of the dresser. And he peed. And he said he almost went crazy trying to flush it. His mom made him wash his own laundry. And Tom said, and from that day to this, from his mouth to my ear, Tom has never been drunk again. That's all it took for him. And that's what he meant by I would get used to it. But you see, Tom's not an alcoholic. Because you see, something happened for me that night that I hope to God I never forget. It illustrated my condition, though I didn't know what my condition was yet. All I can tell you is somewhere between 4 and 5 Budweisers, I got so good looking I couldn't stand it. I mean, hot. I didn't feel retarded or nothing. You know, put the old helmet away, you know. That big old pimple went away. I looked down on the dance floor and I eyeballed me a blue-eyed blonde dancing with some loser. I didn't know I was going to need freedom from blondage. I walked right up to her, having never danced with a woman. The only thing I've ever done is played miniature golf, putt-putt. That's what we did in a special class. See, I got to tell you about that. Moline Miniature Golf was right across 23rd Avenue from Moline High School. But because we're in that class, we can't walk across the street. We have to get loaded up in the front main entrance on the short bus. They drive us across the avenue and then turn the lights on so everybody can see that we're getting off the short bus. And we're going to go play putt-putt all day. So I've never danced. I just play putt-putt. But I overheard one of the boys say to one of the girls, "Can I cut in?" And so I stole the words. I walked right up to that blonde without an ounce of hesitation. And I tried to get the best non-retarded voice I could. Did you ever do that? Start doing this? Do you, I'm not even a stutterer. Do you want to dance? Well, I found out later she recognized me from the special class. So she said yes to give me a sympathy dance. God, I love you girls that do that. Do you know what? We danced another dance. Her date had gone to the bathroom. Big mistake when Wayne's around, I'll tell you that. Because she started liking me. And you know what? She blew him off and she danced with me the rest of the night. Yeah. Yeah. Not yet. Now for the rest of the story. We did. We danced the rest of the night. Later that night, we found out sex meant two people. I didn't know that. You see, they didn't teach us kids in that class anything about sex. Because they didn't want us to know nothing about reproduction. I'll tell you that right now. She ruined my sex life first day out of the gate. I'm going to tell you why. I've been having sex since I was 13. I thought I was good at it. And she kind of complicated the entire procedure that I was used to. I I try not to make eye contact right about there. This should be embarrassing, but it's really not. Found out the next morning, Tom told me I had a great time. I couldn't remember a thing. But I could remember I wanted to do whatever it was we were doing again. I didn't even think about it having anything to do with Budweiser. I don't know nothing about the effect produced. I haven't met Dr. Silkworth's history yet. All I know is I want to do that again. It embedded in me a computer chip that is still on the hard drive to this very day. And that goes something like this. You know, Wayne, when you're feeling different, like you don't fit in, you don't belong, you're not part of, and you're not good enough, have a couple of Budweisers and you will be not only good enough, you will be better than good enough. And I did not know that was embedded right here where it counts. Silkworth calls that an unusual reaction to alcohol. Fast forward, a few weeks later, I got called into the principal's office right before we graduated, and her mom and dad was in there with her. My mom and dad was in there, and here I come, and I'm wondering what the powwow's about. I don't know what's going on here. I'm retarded. What the hell do I know? All I know is when I put my hand on the doorknob, her dad lost his mind. He got up out of his chair. Now, he don't want to mess with my dad because my dad will shoot him. I will guarantee you my dad was strapped in that principal's office. But as soon as he stood up, my dad got up, and I thought, okay, so. As soon as I opened that door, he started screaming at me. Are you the boy that had sex with my girl? Are you the boy that had sex with my girl? He only had to ask once. I said, I was okay with it. I didn't know I'd done nothing wrong. So he told me I was going to go to prison probably for the rest of my life because I've committed statutory rape. Apparently she was 16, I was 17. In the state of Illinois, any boy 14 or older has sex with a girl 16 or younger, statutory rape. And he made sure I understood what he was saying. And he says, I'm going to see to it that you go to jail. And I said, even if you're retarded? By the way, that's a tell. So I found out that the only way to get out of going to jail was to marry her, so Horner and I got married. I want you to picture this for just a minute. Just picture this for a minute. I've been in the retarded class for 4 years. This girl is from a wealthy family. She's 16 and pregnant. See, that's why you screamed at me. Because they had sex, because she was pregnant. Well, mothers didn't let their 16-year-old girls in 1967 go unwed when they're pregnant. So I had a choice, go to prison or get married. Well, I'm a little slow, but not that slow. So we went to Palmyra, Missouri, where you can marry your cousin if you... We got married. So we're coming back. It occurs to me that I'm married, I'm retarded, we're going to have a baby. And I don't know how it happened. So my dad, he says, I got a solution. You know, this is late 67, early 60s. He says, I got a solution. We're going to get you out of town. I said, yes, sir. He says, we're going to join the military. I said, we? So he took me to the recruiters with my, you know, I had my diploma. And by the way, in 1967, they put right on the diploma, retarded class. They do. They don't do that no more. They stopped it in 68. Wouldn't you know it? I just missed. I know it's hard to believe. So my dad takes me to the recruiters, right? We go to the Marine Corps because my dad wanted me to be a Marine. Yeah, that'll make a man out of me, by God. We'll make him a Marine. So the Marine recruiter saw that on the bottom of my transcript. He sent me next door to the Navy. He says, you'll probably fit in good over there. I went next door to the Navy recruiter. My dad helped me fill out the paperwork. I took the entrance exam. Then the recruiter, they wanted bodies back then. The recruiter helped me do my test. I scored in the upper 3rd percentile of the United States Navy. Yeah. Yeah. I got sent to Great Lakes Naval Station for my first boot camp. No, I ain't drank again. That, wouldn't you agree, once is enough? I mean, I got drunk. We got pregnant. I got married. I don't want no more of that action. But I don't know that intellectually. So I get to boot camp at Great Lakes, they put a rifle in my hand, and they found that I could knock a flea off a rope. So I got sent to Coronado Island for advanced training. And then after Coronado Island, they sent me to Treasure Island. And I want you to hear something. There was a TDY, a temporary duty station, pending further action. One day I walked up to the hut where they got the orders posted, and I found my orders. It said, Butler, Wayne E., Seaman, B-586796, new station, PBR, Camera Bay. I didn't know what a PBR was. It's a patrol boat river. And then I went and got more training to get ready for that insanity. I want you to know something. I wasn't ready for that, but they didn't understand. So I ended up going to Vietnam. I was gone a year altogether. I saw things that I was 17 years old when I crossed the water. I was one of the last 17-year-olds that got sent to Vietnam. After a while, you had to be 18 to be sent, because so many 17-year-olds were getting killed in the first few days that they stopped the 17-year-olds from going. I'm not saying that for dramatic effect. That's just a fact. So I got in country before I turned 18, and I turned 18 in a bad situation. I come home, and my wife wanted a divorce. We had the baby. She wanted a divorce. We made up. She got pregnant again. Bad, bad. And then we got divorced. And when we got divorced, I was home on 30 days leave. Haven't drank. I went and drank the divorce. I didn't know what to do with that. So I went and got drunk. And apparently I went into a 5-day blackout. Some of you know what a blackout is. Mine lasted 5 days. First blackout, 5 days. I came out of that blackout driving a car with a woman next to me that I didn't know who she was. Never saw her before in my life. Have you ever done that? You ever come to and you think, besides in your bed where you're trying to chew their leg off to? I'm driving the car and I notice there's a woman next to me, and how do you say, who are you? I'm figuring we must know each other. So I'm trying not to look right at her, because I'm trying to figure out, where the hell do I know her from? I'm going, never saw her before in my life. And then I notice she's wearing a wedding ring. Now I've done it. You see, when I was that little Sunday boy kid, when I went to Sunday school every Sunday, I made a solemn oath to God that I would never, ever commit adultery. That was my oath to God. Now I know I've blown it. I've got a married woman in my car. And she apparently saw that look in my face, and she puts her hand on my arm while I'm driving. And she says, quote, what's the matter, honey? Well, even I know that's not the right name. My name's Wayne. And after she called me honey, I looked right at her and I said, who the hell are you? And she stops crying. She starts crying. I found out you ladies don't like to be asked who you are on your honeymoon. Yeah. Apparently we drove to Palmyra, Missouri, because I knew how to get there. We got married. So I volunteered for another tour of duty in Vietnam. It seemed safer. That's twice. I've been drunk twice now. Can't wait for number three. So I went back to Vietnam again. And I came back, and I don't want to go into those details. They're not appropriate here, but she and I separated. We'd had a baby. And the madness was on me. I didn't even know what the allergy nip says. How can you go a year without drinking and have being an alcoholic? How could you do that? I didn't even understand periodic alcoholism or periodic drinking. You see, for me, alcoholism took place between the drinks. Because during those periods of time where I never had a drink, I was losing my mind. I was. I could not stand reality. Fast forward. Come back in Vietnam the second time. Get an honorable discharge from the United States Navy. I had several medals awarded to me. I was proud of those medals. I was. Now, Thank you. I was proud of those. And I was in anguish. I didn't become an alcoholic because of my family. I didn't become an alcoholic because of the school. I didn't become an alcoholic because of Vietnam. I became an alcoholic because alcohol sounded something to me and for me that nothing else does. And Silkworth alluded to it, and Bill Wilson named it in the 12 and 12. He talked about the effect produced by alcohol. He said it's extemporaneous. I had to look that big word up. Well, Webster helped me out with that. Extemporaneous mainly means without any effort on my part, I have a feeling of normalcy. That's it. I just feel okay with myself. And I want you to know that's what happens to me when I drink Budweiser. I can do, see, and believe those which I cannot do, see, and believe on my unaided resources alone, as says the book. We did the dance of death for a few years. And by winter of 1972, I'm living on Skid Row. I've left my wife. I've left my family. My father took me to court and got a restraining order against me because I was acting badly. I'll just leave it at that. He got a restraining order against me because of something I did when I was drunk and because of something I did when I was undrunk. He took me to court, and the judge granted a restraining order, and it went like this. I cannot go within 1,000 yards of my own mother. I cannot go within 1,000 yards of my own children. I cannot go within 1,000 yards of my wife or my ex-wife. I mean, this was a blanket restraining order. I got outside the courthouse. My dad comes around the back, and he comes walking up behind me. And my dad was a man of his word. If he said he'll knock you out, he'll knock you out. That's just the way he was. I'm not painting a bad picture. That's just the way he was. He walked up to me, and he says, boy, you and I both know that that restraining order ain't worth the paper it's written on. And he pulled a pistol out of his back belt, and he put it right to my forehead. My father put a pistol right to my forehead. And he says, know this, if I find out you've gone near any of my grandkids or your mother, I'm putting you down. 6 months later, I'm living on Skid Row. Not because I drank, but because I have alcoholism. There's a big difference, kids. And from 1972 to 1977, I lived on Skid Row. I lived behind Larry's Oasis. And I want to tell you about that. Apparently, my dad had gone off and joined this cult called AA. See, I'm sleeping in a dumpster behind Larry's Oasis. It's a BFI, Brown Ferris Industries. They're mobbed up, so I was kind of cool. Halloween night, 1972. It's a little after midnight, November 1st. And I hear a knock on my dumpster lid. I was home. Alone, because some of you women are kind of picky. I couldn't even get Dirty Sally to come home with me. I tried. I mean, she'd go home with anybody. No offense, but she would. One night, I talked her into coming home with me, and when she got to the front door of my dumpster, she says, oh, no, I am not that drunk. And that kind of hurt my feelings. I felt rejected. And, so here's my dad. I wondered who was out there because, you know, the dumpster pickup man ain't coming at 1 a.m. So I got to know who's out there. So that's when I lifted the lid up, and I saw my dad, and I'm waiting to see the pistol because I figure my dad's there to put me down. And instead, he had a look in his eye I've never seen before. My dad was a dangerous man. He was hurt. You know, hurt people hurt people. And he was a very dangerous man. So I'm looking for the pistol. Now, I want to tell you something. If you're an alcoholic of my type, you'll understand this. I was hoping he had a gun because I didn't have the courage to do it. And I thought, you know what? Maybe my war's over. I can't go on like this. And I was to go on 5 more years. But my dad looks at me in that dumpster and he says, Wayne, do you want to come home with me tonight? He was paying a 12-step call on me. I didn't know that then. He said, Wayne, do you want to come home with me tonight? And I looked around my little room. And I said, no, thanks, Dad. I'm doing fine. Now, if you lived on Skid Row, you know exactly what I mean by that. I was okay. You see, I have the devastated hopelessness of the chronic alcoholic, which means there isn't any bottom I can't dig that I can't make peace with. That's why if you go to your local Skid Row, you cannot talk those people into leaving. You cannot talk them into leaving because that's home. And my dad was offering me to come home with him. No thanks, Dad, I'm doing fine. And he left. He left. Now, I assumed he was going to get the gun. Now, I don't know why. I don't know why I didn't want to wait to find out. But I jumped out of that dumpster. And I began that walk of walks that every man and woman in this room has walked. Yours might not have started out at a dumpster. It might have started out in that Cadillac you parked on the front porch. Or that closet you passed out in naked and he or she found you in the morning. Bottom's relative to the individual, isn't it? I jumped out of that dumpster and I began that walk. And I came across this restaurant called Harvey's Restaurant. It was an old mom and pop coffee shop. You older folks remember those? Truck driver coffee shop. Dime for a cup of coffee. And you can have all the refills you want. And I got there. It was about 2 in the morning. It was an all-night coffee shop, of course. And I looked inside that window. Wasn't anybody in there. This was Halloween night. Wasn't anybody in there. 2 o'clock. Except one woman. Some 800-year-old woman. Was slowly wiping down the coffee bar. I looked at her, sized her up, knew I could get her to sympathize with me. She might give me something to eat, maybe some cigarettes. That's the only reason I went in there. I wasn't going looking for no help. I was going in there to get something handed out to me. I walked in that door and my odor hit her before I did. You remember those old malt shop stools that wobble? Remember those? I think they did that so they couldn't tell if you was drunk or not. I really do. And I sat at one closest to the cash register for some reason. And as she's wiping down the coffee bar, the same time I'm sitting down, she's looking up because she notices me. And she done something that struck me peculiar. She smiled at me. She went and got a cup of coffee and a glass of water, brought it over to me and set it down in front of me. And then she says, "What can I do for you, sweetie?" Ain't nobody said sweetie to me in a long time. She took me off my game. I was ready to work her. I had it all set, right? It took me back, but I found my balance. And I went right after her. I started telling her about the alcoholic home. I told her about the beatings I took. I told her things I didn't even want to tell my sponsor when I got sober, just so I'd get something to eat. I told her about being kidnapped as a little boy by 2 men in the neighborhood, locked in a coal bin for 3 days and brutalized. And I was. Tears start rolling down her eyes. I told her about what happened to me in that special class. I told her about Vietnam. I told her about my divorce. Alligator tears were rolling down her face. I even made something up just to get more tears. I even made myself cry. I thought I was winning. You know why she was crying? She'd heard it before. She was in a program called Al-Anon. By the way, you Al-Anons, if you work in a place like that, had the decency to put an identification badge on. She was working me like a fine-tuned instrument. Let me tell you why she's being so kind. She recognized right away that I might have a drinking problem. She's married to a guy named Harvey who owns the restaurant. Harvey's having a hard time staying sober. And she learned in Al-Anon that Harvey's single only hope is to have another alcoholic to work with. So she took me hot. She kept me there. From that morning on November 1st until November 3rd, she let me mop and wax the dining room floor. She'd give me sausage sandwiches. What she was doing was waiting for Harvey to show back up. And late November 2nd, Harvey showed up, and she had told him that there was a guy there that needed him. Harvey's this little guy, about that big, stone cold, butt ugly, I'm telling you right now. You know, I didn't have low self-esteem. I had none. But I looked at him, and it came up a little bit, I thought. I mean, he had this nose. We call it whiskey nose in Chicago. Straight here, but golf balls on both sides. And he had these red and blue and purple blood veins running through his face. I didn't know what it was, but that's called spider angioma. That's late stage fatal alcoholism. And I swear to God, when his heart beat, his nose went like this. Wow. That man is ugly. And he shakes my hand, and he's giving me the bum's handshake. He's got a coin in his hand. And while he's shaking my hand, I'm trying to determine what kind of coin it is. Because it ain't no silver dollar. I know that, because I know what those feel like. It's too big to be a half a dollar. I'm wondering what it is. While I'm trying to figure it out, he's talking to me. He says, you take this coin down to 410 16th Street tomorrow about noontime. You show them this coin. You tell them Harvey sent you. They're going to help you. So when I opened my hand up, you know what that coin was? It was a brass coin. And on this side, it had these two A's that weren't even straight. And nothing else. Two A's. He says to me, turn it over. You know how they are. These old timers can get glib. So I turned it over, and I read that. It had a prayer, a stupid prayer. I'm looking for food. A prayer. Said, God grant me something. But it didn't say nothing about money, food, shelter, or pell-mell tailor-made cigarettes. So I took that coin down to 410 16th Street the next day about noontime, just like Harvey said. And Harvey told me when I got there, it's in the cellar. It's in the basement, this place where his friends are. And he said, in the cellar window, there'd be a light bulb hanging on a cord. He said, if that light's on, they're there. Go in. They're expecting you. So I got there the next day about noontime, and I found the address. It was in the basement. The cellar windows were painted black. I found out that was for anonymity. And in the one corner, the paint was scraped away. It was a light bulb. Now, he said if it was on, go in. It was flickering. Harvey didn't give me a contingency plan. He didn't tell me what to do if it was flickering. So I'm out there. People are walking by me going downstairs, right? And I'm staring at that light trying to will it to stop so I can go in. I'm out there like this, trying to get the light to stop. I lost my mind. I couldn't go in. I don't have permission. I need help. I left. I couldn't go in. Wouldn't stop flickering. I went to Larry's Oasis and mooched me some Budweiser's. Got oiled up. And that night, shortly before 8 o'clock, now I'm oiled up. Now I'm going back to get what they owe me. Because they owe me now. You ever done that? So I go back to that place, and I don't even care about the light bulb now. I've had the effect produced. I went charging down that basement doorway on a full dead bull run. You know, a rush, not a run, but you know what I mean. Well, I failed to notice that the basement doorway is 5'10"-ish. I'm 6'3"-ish. And I ran right into that door header. And that door header cracked me right across the eyebrow. It lifted me off of my feet. And I slid into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Inside that door was a round table. Round. I found out later it was round because they didn't want the devil to corner you. Yeah. So there's six or seven old men must have been talking about death and dying. And I slid right between two of them. And this old buzzard got up out of his chair and he goes just like this, standing over me. He's snarling at me. And then he growled at me. He went just like this. Slide right in here, you big dummy. And then he gets that quirky old-timer grin. He says, we got a wrench to fit every nut that comes in the door. And then he looks me up and down and he says, and by the looks of you, it's going to need an adjustable wrench. Now, I ain't liking this guy right away. And I'm on the deck. The wind's been knocked out of me. I'm trying to catch my breath. You know, if you ever had the wind knocked out of you, that is not a comfortable thing. I'm trying to breathe and he's trying to help me, I guess. And as I get my breath back, he then introduces himself. He says, my name's Barney. I didn't ask. You know what I mean? And then he says, I'm an alcoholic. I thought, what? Alcoholic? I started feeling sorry for him right away. You see, he said he's alcoholic, but I can top that. So I says to him, I says, you're alcoholic? He says, I am. Well, I'm ADD. He says, I'll bet you are. I said, not only that, but I'm OCD, or I'm OCD. And he says, I'm sure you are. He says, you know what else? I think you're ODD too. Now, I never heard that one. I've read the DSM-3 all the way through, never saw ODD. So I said to him, I said, what's ODD? He says, you are very odd. You ever just want to smack them? And then he says, and I'm going to be your sponsor. Now, I've been in AA 13 seconds. I know his name. I know his diagnosis. And now he's trying to give it to me. In that instant, I told myself, I will never say I'm an alcoholic. Never. Where'd that come from? And hung out around that guy. I said, okay. I know what a sponsor is. I've had a sponsor. I played baseball. I had a sponsor. Paid league fees, bought uniforms, gave us a little spending money. That's a sponsor. Well, he fell short. Let me tell you that right now. Stayed that night, didn't know what the hell went on, and I left, and I went back to my dumpster. I want you to hear something loud and clear. For the next 5 years and 5 days, I went to meetings on a regular basis and drank before every meeting. I drank after every meeting, and I went back to my dumpster every night. It's a hell of a way to live. But I was okay with it. And during that 5 years and 5 days, I'd sit in meetings. They'd even let me talk every now and then, trying to get me to say I'm an alcoholic, I suppose. But I would not say I'm an alcoholic. I would say I only drink beer. How do you fight that, right? I only drink beer. And I only drink so often. I'm not a daily drinker. I'm not even every other day drinker. You know, on Skid Row, you hardly drink. You want to know the truth. You hear a lot of different stories, but when you live on the row, you don't drink all that much. You just exist. And then you go get what you can. But I needed to have that effect produced, and I didn't know it until I met you folks. Now, fast forward. 4.5 years going to meetings and drinking. I don't know what it is about this guy, Barney, but I got to see him. I got to be around him. I got to be by him. I don't know why. I don't know what it is. But I keep going back. I have no intention of stopping drinking, but I keep going back to the Moline group to sit by Barney. And I knew enough to behave most of the time. I come walking. I'm not happy to tell you this story, but I'm going to tell it to you. I come walking into a meeting one night drinking. And I took to carrying a gun and a knife at the time. And the speaker was speaking just like I am, and I walked right in front of him late. Barney's sitting there right where Tony is. And as I walked by Barney, apparently he whispered it, but I thought he yelled it. He said, hey, dummy. He says, are you aware this program tends to work better if you don't drink? Now, what I heard him say was, you have to quit drinking. And I walked to the other side of the room, and the thought that I can't drink no more caused me to go down to my boot and pull that pistol out, point it at my sponsor's face, and I fired a round off at him. And I missed him. Now, I'm a combat expert marksman. I want you to hear that. I'm not bragging. I'm reporting. I missed him 6 inches high from less than 30 feet away. I came to the next morning at Franciscan Mental Health Center in Rock Island, Illinois, my 17th trip to the psych ward. I was strapped down in a padded room to a steel bed in the center of the room. The bed was only 4 inches off the floor, bolted down. I was in 6-point leather restraints, and I was black and blue from head to toe from little AA group therapy. They broke things I didn't know I had. The nurse could not help but tell me what a scumbag I am. She'd seen me so many times. That was my 17th trip to the psych ward. I had a visitor that very next morning at 10 o'clock. You know who that visitor was? Barney. I couldn't believe it. I wouldn't have come. I wouldn't have been there. I thought he was there to get me. I'm tied down. I can't defend myself. They even took my teeth. I think he's afraid I might chew through the straps or something. Barney comes in. He's walking around my bed. I've got 3 broken ribs. I mean, they tore me up. And he pushes the rib and asks me if it still hurts. Yeah, I noticed that. And he said, "Dummy, there's something wrong with you. I don't even know if you're alcoholic. You might just be nuts. I don't know." And then he says what I want to tell you that I've never forgot. He says, "However, if they let you out of here, and I'm not sure they're going to, they're talking about keeping you and studying you a while, but if they let you out of here, you can come with me. We'll go and do what we did and still do, and I think you can recover too." I don't think that's what I would have said if someone tried to shoot me. I fell in love with AA that day through him. I didn't know it intellectually. I was in there for quite some time. I was on a court commitment, and I found out an interesting fact. When you're on a court commitment to a psychiatric hospital, you have no legal rights of any kind. None. Zero. Can't even have a lawyer. You have no rights. And they performed electric shock treatment on me. And then the state of Illinois overruled shock treatment while I was in there, and so they had administered insulin shock treatment. 6 months later, they let me out to Barney's care. And he went to a meeting and I got drunk. This is the most baffling, cunning disease unknown to science. How is it that I can come here to a room like this with you people and I can get help? I can go to any treatment center, any hospital, and they can feed me. They can get me healthy physically. They can get me going, but they cannot recover me because recovery doesn't happen in 31 days. It's a kickstart. Recovery takes place in AA if you're an alcoholic of my type, as described in the big book, The Real Alcoholic. So before I get all bogged down in that, on November 7th, Barney says to me, "Why don't you come to the meeting tomorrow and help me set up for the noon meeting?" And I said, "I'll be there, Barney." I did. I showed up every time. I just drank, right? Barney says, "Why don't you come early?" He says, "Why don't you try not to drink tonight, just tonight? You don't have to quit. Just don't drink tonight." And I said, "Barney, you know I can't do that. I can't grow the rest of my life without a drink." He says, "No, just tonight." I know what he's talking about. He's talking about the rest of my life. I know that. So I said to him, "Barney, I cannot go the rest of my life without a drink." And he says, "How about midnight? Can you go till midnight?" And I said, "Barney, that's a piece of cake. Anybody can go till midnight without a drink." So I made it till 7 a.m. And I was walking up through Belgian Village in Moline, Illinois, and I swiped a 6-pack of warm Budweiser. Now, I want to tell you about my bottom. I got to the Moline group about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, something like that, or 9 o'clock. I don't remember the exact time. I sat on the front steps of the Moline group and started drinking that warm Budweiser at the AA group. Now, there was a guy inside named Tom, another Tom. He had 14 days. How do I know? Because he announced it every day. When he had 3 days, "I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic. And I have 3 days." Day 7. "I'm Tom. I got 7 days. I prayed for him, but he wouldn't die. When he had 10 days, he said, my name's Tom and I'm an alcoholic. And my sponsor's Barney. No, he's not. No, he's mine. We don't have room for two of us here. So for the next 4 days, I plotted his demise in between my drinking. Tom's got to go. Well, Tom's inside at the coffee bar working on his four step already, 14 day. Now they are. Walking through the steps. So I'm sitting on the front steps drinking warm Budweiser and Tom's working his steps. So I get three cans of beer drank. And here comes Barney early, just like he said, about 10 o'clock for a noon meeting. You know how they are. Kind of rigid, you know. She comes walking up on me. Now there's three empty cans of Budweiser on the ground and three in the lap that I'm going to drink. Barney doesn't even look at the beer. He does something worse. Looks me right in the eye, causing me to look down to the beer. Now that beer was good till he showed up. You know what he says to me? He says, dummy. I said, yes, sir. He says, why don't you come on in and help me set up for the meeting? I don't want to have to do it by myself. And I said, Barney, I'll be in a minute. And he never said another word, and he walked in. And as that door slammed quietly shut, a shudder went through me. Is it God or is it odd? Who's to say? All I know is I had this overpowering impulse to go help him set up. And I hid those other three cans of beer in a bush because I didn't want nobody to find them. You know, Big Book Bob might show up requiring me to drink. Big Book Bob, in the book. Page, in the book. Every group's got one of them. In the book. My sponsor signed my book. Bunch of trolls, you know what I mean? In the book. So I put the beer away in the bush, and I went in and helped Barney set up for the meeting. I happened to notice Tom didn't help, by the way. He was too busy working the steps to be of service. I noticed that. So he done setting up, and all of a sudden I see Barney up at the coffee bar with Tom, working his step. I'm plotting his death. I really am. I'm not trying to underscore that at all. He needed to die. I didn't necessarily want to get sober, but I wanted Barney back. And as I'm in that back row having set up the room, I'm looking at Tom trying to figure out how I'm going to get him out in the parking lot without Barney knowing. And then the front door flew open. And this guy come flying in like this, I swear to God. And then he just stopped like he ran out of air. And he just hit the deck just like that. And he bounced like a carp, you know? And it's like, he was so drunk, I could smell the booze. Now, I'm not drunk. I've only had three beers, and they were warm. You know what I mean? So I'm having a lucid interval. And he hit the deck. Two things happened simultaneously. I saw him hit the deck, and I saw Barney and Tom notice. Now, I know what they're going to do. Barney's going to go fish him up. And then it's going to be two against one. I got to kill them both. I've been doing this for 5 years and 5 days, kids. I've not once said I'm an alcoholic, because I'm not going to. That means you join, right? But I saw Barney and Tom looking at this guy, and I thought, I better go get to him and help him, or they're going to. I don't know what to do. I've had three beers. Not for a few minutes, though. I was officially sober, you know. So I went out and got him and picked. He couldn't stand up. He's too drunk. We figured his wife did a drive-by, you know what I mean? So I picked him up, and I'm holding him up. He cannot stand up. So I got him, and he's going like this. And I don't know what to do with him. All I know is I don't want Barney to get him. So I got him. I'm holding on to him as tight as I can, and I don't know what to say. I know I got to say something, like, hi, I don't know. Now I remember what Barney said to me 5 years and 5 days ago. So I said, hi, my name's Wayne B. And he goes like this. We'll say Jimmy, because that was his name. And I don't know what to say. And what Barney said went right through my mind before I could put the brakes on it. And I said, and I'm an alcoholic. No! You ever tried to take back something you said before they hear it? You talk about the speed of sound. I couldn't catch it before he heard it. Barney heard me say, I'll be your sponsor. Because that's what he said. I said, and I'm going to be your sponsor. Because that's what Barney said to me. Well, when Barney heard me say, I'll be your sponsor, he looked and he abandoned Tom at the coffee bar. Now, if I'd have known all I got to do to get him away from Tom is just tell somebody I'll be their sponsor, I'd have done it 13 days ago. I'll tell you that right now. Barney, like a light, got off of that coffee bar and started heading my way. And I know what he's going to do. He's going to poach Jimmy. I got him. He's mine. So I pulled Jimmy behind me, and I'm holding him up by the belt. He can't stand up. I got him. He's mine. Barney gets about this far from my face. I'm expecting him to take him away. He whispers in my ear, dummy, don't talk to me like that in front of my sponsee. I know none of you think like that. He says, do you mind if I co-sponsor him? No. No, you can't. He's mine. Barney was just like that Al-Anon. Barney knew I needed Jimmy. So he didn't take Jimmy away from me. You know what he says instead? He says, you mind if I co-sponsor him? Now, I don't know what a co-sponsor is, but I knew I didn't have no choice. What I thought was, no, you can't have him. He's mine. What I said was, okay. And me and Jimmy became the 12-step warriors. We didn't know what we were doing, but we did it. Did I say that? That's it. We didn't know what we were doing. We had a big book. And we didn't have a treatment center on every corner. It was up to us to go get them. So me and Jimmy had a group unconscious. We don't want to clue Barney in until we do it. You know, it's easier to get forgiveness than permission. So me and Jimmy get an idea. We have a plan. We've developed a plan. By the way, in honor of Scott Redmond, you guys that are new, we know you have a plan on how to live your sobriety. I want you to know that I have a plan for my sobriety right now on how to treat my dis-ease. Would you like to hear my plan? It's a really good plan. Here's how my plan works. I treat loneliness with isolation. I treat anxiety with caffeine and sugar. And I treat depression with country western music. How much time I got back there? What, 15, 20 minutes? What? What? I think 9:48, actually. I'm just playing. I know what time. I'm just trying to give you a voice. You know what I mean? Fast forward. God, I hate to tell this, but I have to. You know, my dad died drunk. He never got sober again. A year and a half. He drank on Thanksgiving Day in 1977. My dad drank in front of me after 9.5 years of sobriety. And I was going to pick up a drink with my dad, and I called my sponsor instead, and my sponsor came and got me. I didn't drink. He didn't tell me not to drink. He just came and got me and took me for a ride. Talked about himself the whole time, which is rude. My dad invited me home for Thanksgiving dinner. That's when he drank. They came out with a new beer called Miller Lite. My dad says to me, "Surely, Wayne, that beer can't hurt me and you. I've got 16 days of it. What do I know?"
Sure.
My sponsor is the one who stopped me from drinking. Is it God or is it odd? Who's to say? I didn't drink. And from that day to this day, I just haven't drank. And I've had a lot of ups and downs in my life. Going through one right now. I've had a lot of medical issues recently. And it's not good. It is what it is. But it's no hill for a climber, as it were. As a matter of fact, I ain't saying this for pity or for brag, but I met with my doctor Tuesday, and he says, "You cannot fly. You cannot fly." I said, "Okay, so here I am." Well, look, how many times you hear people say, "Don't talk about pills because you're not a doctor." Well, he's not an alcoholic, so here I am. I've had a lot of medical issues going on. Now, Friday night, Rich did a good job of describing the process. What I want to do tonight, and I have, is just share about the identification. Because, folks, if we don't identify, we won't stay. If we don't identify, we won't stay. And the way we identify in Alcoholics Anonymous is by storytelling. That's how we identify. How many of you have laughed tonight? Welcome to AA, kids. Because this ain't funny. This ain't funny. Try to do this at a comedy club and they'll throw apples at you. Rotten apples. This ain't funny. The reason it's funny is because the heart identifies what the mind can't understand. You hear me? And so I've tried tonight to share honestly about what I was like as a broken spirit. You know, at that first convention I went to when I had 18 days, my sponsor took me to that convention, and not the speakers, but the members of AA, you hear the speakers. The speakers are all around. You hear them? Those things, those are speakers. You hear me? I'm not a speaker. I'm a member of AA who's willing to come and share my experience, strength, and hope. When I become a speaker, my ego gets involved. And I think I've got the most dangerous job in all of AA. This is the one job that's very dangerous because the ego is so fragile, said Chuck C. One last thing I want to share with you in about the 8 minutes I got left here. You know, my family's not back together again. Hardly any of my family. We were a wolf pack driven apart by the disease of alcoholism. Six of my members of my family, four died drunk. One committed suicide. I found her. She hung herself, and I'm the one that found her. I didn't mention this, but I became a cop sober. I know it's kind of hard to believe. You know, I've been arrested 9 times and psychiatrically institutionalized 17, and I became a cop sober. Ain't that something? You can't. That's impossible. Now, I know some of you aren't impressed by that, and you should clean those warrants up as soon as you can. It is impossible to become a cop, and you got the record I've got. Unless you're in AA, you do the work. You hear me? See, unless you live in Iowa, because there they consider it a good experience. So, I didn't become a cop to be a hero or a legend. I became a cop to serve. And I got assigned to drunk driving, and I got to grab you guys up and give you a decent arrest. And I was able to go before the judge and talk to the judge into letting you come sit with us instead of go sit with them in jail. And over the course of 5 years, 37 men and women, instead of going to prison, they came to Alcoholics Anonymous because God used me and put me in that squad car. You hear me? Fast forward. June 6th of 2012, my son got arrested. He was drunk and loaded on drugs, and he pointed a gun at a cop. Yep. You know who that cop was? He's a deputy sheriff who's getting ready to retire. He's my training officer. And he recognized my son, and he didn't shoot him. And I went and got my son. Stayed sober for 1 day short of 2 years. Then he got a job bartending, and he's gone again. And then his mother went out with 32 years of sobriety with him. And I know exactly why, and I want to share that with you before I'm done. There's only one reason, in my opinion, we drink again. And Bill put it right in the big book. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Now, my doctor cannot understand why I would risk my condition to come here. It's not so I'm a hero, big shot speaker. I love the hay. And I want you newcomers to know there's no excuse. None. Some people would say this was stupid of me to come here. No, the love has lifted me up. I've been lifted up this whole weekend. What greater thing is there to heal the human spirit than love and laughter? And where else can you laugh at yourself and have people laugh with you and not to have to take a drink to make me feel better or to get the effect produced that I so desperately want is to quit hurting mentally, emotionally. After I was a cop, I moved to California, met a lot of good people here that I love and they love me. And the reason I share that is my son's still out there. My son's mother's out there. My dad died drunk. My uncle died drunk. My cousin died drunk. My son's mother might. My son might. Because they cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Many of us in this room aren't going to stay. Because those of us who have given ourselves up, the temptation of this disease is to pull away. And I learned something from Chuck C. that I want to pass on to you. You've heard some people say, the farther I get away from my first drink, the closer I get to my next one. That ain't how Chuck C. said it. Let me share with you how he put it to me. He says, the farther I get away from my loving Father God and AA, the closer I get to a drink. Isn't that the truth? The farther I get away from God and AA, the closer I am to my next drink. And so I stay plugged in. I've got a great life on the inside. You see, the power's in here. It isn't my power. It's a God-given power. Chuck taught me that I got to get away from all that stuff that obscures me from God so that I can connect and stay connected. And based on that, I get to be with you kids here. And you're my elders. When I say I stand on the shoulders of giants, I do. My first convention, there were 6 members of AA that gave up their holiday to come talk in Rock Island, Illinois. A guy by the name of Chuck Chamberlain, Norm Elpe, Dottie Shore, and Tom Brady. And a guy named Clancy and a guy named Johnny. I guess God thought I needed an overdose. My sponsor died. He had been my sponsor 29 years, 5 months, and 14 days. And I want to tell you about how God works. I was at a men's retreat in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was co-retreat master with Tom I from Southern Pines, North Carolina. I got a phone call standing outside a maximum security penitentiary in Nashville. I got a phone call, Barney just died, and Tom was standing right next to me. And I don't know what to do. That was it right there. Isn't that funny how this works? That's not sad, by the way. What a gift to have somebody in my life like that that gives me an opportunity to move upward and onward. And lastly, I want to talk about something that'll take just a couple of minutes. I learned a valuable lesson about the source and the solution. I've learned through Chuck C.'s work that the source for all power is God as you understand him, as I understand him. That's the source, not the solution. The solution is Alcoholics Anonymous. I need the source and the solution intertwined. And I want you newcomers to know something. As long as I stay connected to the source and the solution, I shall remain free. And I will be happy and I will be joyous no matter what hill I've got to climb. I am not in the shadow of doubt today. I'm a really happy guy on the inside. And I hope if you're new, maybe you need to be renewed. I hope that you will find a way to completely give yourself to this simple program. And if you can, the Big Book promises you will find happy, joyous, and free. Thank you for letting me be with you tonight.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions. Toll free 1-877-893-2777 or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.